Small versus Commonwealth, Bradley Rittenhouse, Haywood Public Defender Appellant Counsel, Catherine Finlan, Adelphia Assistant Attorney General, Appellee Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brad Haywood for the appellant, Andrew Schmoll. We're asking the court to grant the appeal on all grounds, but I want to highlight, at least pattern my argument following the framework involving 2 points. The first of which is the Court of Appeals, their finding that involuntary intoxication is a species of insanity defense was contrary to law and precedent. And secondly, even if it was not, Court of Appeals did not fairly represent the proceedings in the trial court, and in particular the fact that Schmoll complied with the insanity provisions of the code. Very briefly, regarding the facts, Mr. Schmoll's wife had been an attorney at the victim's law firm. Shortly after losing her job, it was alleged that she and Mr. Schmoll went to the victim's home, entered it, abducted the victim and his wife, and inflicted serious bodily injury. During that time, Mr. Schmoll was on 14 different medications, including 7 different painkillers. Maybe all but one, were narcotics. The conduct that was in the home was absolutely bizarre. It involved an identity that could be barely disguised because the victim knew him. It involved allegations of, or at least claims of, and Mexican drug cartels were involved in a hit that had been placed out on the victim.
May I ask you this? Pre-trial, when the notice was given, the insanity notice was given, the judge provided an election. Just tell me, are you making this an insanity notice or not? And as I recall the record, it was no, I'm not claiming this as an insanity notice. And matters put off until trial. And then I'm looking at J2176, the judge follows back and says to defense counsel, the view you took at the time, that is pretrial, was that it was not an insanity defense. That's what you were advocating. And defense counsel says, I still am. And the court says, so what follows from this is that the Commonwealth did not have a right to have your client evaluated, because if you're right and that it's not an insanity defense, they don't have a right to evaluate your client. And the answer is essentially right. So how can the trial judge be faulted for not ordering the evaluation and putting together the conflict with that?
Your Honor, I believe the notice, first of all, speaks for itself, and it complies completely with the insanity provisions of the Virginia Code, and it states what the defendant's intent was. The defendant's intent was to introduce a defense where his mental state met the legal standard for insanity, and he said he was going to provide evidence, including expert opinion.
But the position taken at trial, pretrial, and at trial is it's not an insanity defense notice that triggers the right of the Commonwealth under the insanity notice statute. I mean, that just seems like a bait and switch to me.
Well, more to your point, Your Honor, the majority of those pretrial proceedings that occurred in November and December of 2015 were about what is the nature of an involuntary intoxication defense. Okay. And very quickly, in fact, in its first pleading in response to Mr. Schmoll's notice, second pleading, the Commonwealth took the firm position that these were 2 different defenses, that involuntary intoxication was not a species of insanity defense, and that the insanity provisions of the code would not apply to any involuntary intoxication defense. The trial court also agreed with that, and quite frankly, this came up, I imagine, 30 different times, and it was made clear to the court that it was made clear to the appellant, or to the defendant at that time, that this was the choice that was, this was a line that was being drawn, this or that. So when the trial judge asked the question, are you presenting an insanity notice? What he was asking at that time was, are you providing a notice of insanity by mental defect or disorder, or are you providing a notice of insanity by involuntary intoxication? Clearly, the answer to that question is that it was by involuntary intoxication. And never vacillated on that point at all. It came up pretty much routinely throughout the trial, and that was the consistent position of Mr. Schmoll.
So did the Commonwealth have a right to evaluate your client?
So as I noted in our brief, I believe that trial court was correct that the involuntary intoxication and insanity are not, or involuntary intoxication is not a species of insanity defense. So had the court ordered an evaluation following that, and the defendant had refused to comply, then I don't believe that it would have been error for the defendant refused to comply. Or it would have been error for the court to order that. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. But with respect to, let me just blank out those thoughts for a moment.
Well, if it's an insanity defense, the notice should be given, the notice is applicable to it, and the rights of both parties are governed by the insanity defense statutes. But the notice was given, it was disclaimed as an insanity defense, and at trial it was doubled down as not that, and therefore the Commonwealth did not have the rights that it would have if, in fact, involuntary intoxication should be understood simply as a subset of the McNaughton's insanity doctrine. So if it were, if the Court of Appeals is right, that that should be understood as just one application of McNaughton, then the Court of Appeals is right. Why are they wrong if their predicate assumption is right?
Which part are you asking about, wrong or right?
If involuntary intoxication is simply an application of the McNaughton test, an insanity doctrine, common law insanity doctrine, not statutory, and the statutory notice provisions for that kind of defense were applicable, it would require the notice, it would require the evaluation, require actually a lot of very detailed procedural requirements. But the Commonwealth was not given the opportunity because, as I read the record, the notice was disclaimed as an insanity defense, and at trial, when the matter was deferred for a final decision, it was doubled down on. I'm not raising that. In which case, the trial judge said to himself, well, if you're not raising it, I guess I can't order the insanity procedures. So what did the trial judge do wrong?
Your Honor, the defendant at no time abandoned exactly what his notice was, and kept reiterating that during these pretrial proceedings. So, and this was, in fact, the only person that anticipated this potentially being the legal framework was the defendant, and that was the reason that the notice was provided. At that point, it was made clear to the trial court that the defendant's position was this area of law was extremely unclear, and that in the event that the court found that involuntary intoxication was a species of insanity defense, notice was being provided. It never in any insanity case is a proper required of what the nature of the insanity defense is. The court could no more order us to say exactly what the involuntary intoxication, the nature of that defense was going to be, than it could at the beginning, very beginning, when a notice is provided of an insanity defense, to say what's the mental disease that's being relied on, how to affect somebody's brain. So that's what the Commonwealth was trying to elicit from the defendant. And all we were saying was, you can't do that. There's no obligation on us to do that. If the court makes a threshold determination that every involuntary intoxication defense is an insanity defense, then we will comply in full with these insanity provisions. The court said it was unable to do that, and said it was unable to do that without hearing more, without hearing that proffer that it wanted to hear, that we were under no obligation to give. The threshold determination that it needed to make, it actually made. It just made it incorrectly. The question was, is in all cases an involuntary intoxication defense an insanity defense? And if it is indeed true that it is, then the trial court got that wrong. And by getting that wrong, it did not order Mr. Schmoll to comply with the insanity provisions of the code, never told him to submit to an evaluation by the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth abandoned that attempt to get an evaluation completed. And Mr. Schmoll was not out of compliance. He had provided notice. He had, in fact, indicated, I think, repeatedly, of his intent to comply had the trial court simply made those orders, which it did not do.
And you're basically saying between what happened at trial and the Court of Appeals, you're in a catch-22 type situation, right?
That was absolutely a catch-22. And I think that was the whole point. Is we were, what can we be expected to do? When the law is unclear like this, we have to do our best to be able to preserve our ability to present evidence. And I can't anticipate exactly how a trial court's going to rule. This seemed to me the right way to do it. The trial court, by getting the legal determination wrong, did not order us to comply with the insanity provisions, and it didn't happen. Because they never ordered us, we shouldn't have been precluded from
that. We're assuming that involuntary intoxication is functionally the same as medication-induced delirium, a neurocognitive disorder recognized by the DSM-5, right? Because we're throwing around involuntary intoxication, but at trial, that was what you wanted the expert to testify to was medication-induced delirium, which sounds an awful lot like involuntary intoxication, but maybe different.
This is where we get into, I don't know if this answers Your Honor's question, but there's a firm line that's drawn in most jurisdictions. In fact, it's strongly implied in Virginia precedent. What separates intoxication from insanity? In order to get to settled insanity, there's been an argument, well, this was in the Court of Appeals, but it was that the nature or character of the effects should be what defines, you know, whether it becomes settled insanity. And they said it doesn't have anything to do with that. The appellant in that case, it doesn't have anything to do, this is Morgan, it doesn't have anything to do with duration. The court said, well, actually, it does have everything to do with duration. And every other court that has addressed this issue has done the same thing. So if the disturbance of the mind happens when drugs are introduced to the body, and it ends when they're out of the body, then that's intoxication, and that's exactly what happened here. And I think there was overwhelming evidence of that fact. I think the situation would be different had the disturbance persisted well beyond having been given Narcan. Immediately upon being given Narcan, there was a reaction, as if the body was responding to that. And then when they removed, I think the other drug, one of the other drugs was Clonidine, and that was very quickly Mr. Schmoll's condition started to improve, and he no longer appeared delirious.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I was getting at is the court finding that what you wanted to present, medication-induced delirium and neurocognitive disorder, et cetera, was not involuntary intoxication. It was something else. Right? And you're saying, wrong. It's a fancified way of saying involuntary intoxication using the terminology of the DSM-5, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that the trial court, actually, trial court's belief is that once you reach, and this was made clear during the presentation of the expert testimony, once you have words like psychosis or dissociation or delirium involved in having been triggered, you know, those conditions being triggered by a substance, then it's no longer intoxication, it's insanity. And I believe that's just simply not supported by the law. Any condition for involuntary intoxication to satisfy the monotonous standard, it's going to have to be one of those. And it's a group of symptoms coming together is what a disorder is. So once you're at psychosis, that's just the most extreme version of intoxication. Or delirium is the same way, or dissociation is the same way. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth. This is not a situation where the defendant intended to put on an involuntary intoxication defense predicated solely on toxicology evidence or pharmacology evidence. This is a situation where the defendant's involuntary intoxication defense was based in part on mental health evidence presented by a mental health expert who had actually evaluated the defendant. As noted in this court's discussion with opposing counsel, prior to trial, there was extensive litigation regarding the scope of the evidence that the defendant was entitled to present and that he, in fact, intended to present during the course of the proceedings. The prosecutor at one of the first pretrial hearings in November of 2015 acknowledged that the defendant had previously indicated that he wished to pursue an insanity defense and that he planned to present mental health evidence where the Commonwealth and the prosecutor articulated a concern that it would not have the opportunity to rebut this evidence absent a its own evaluation of the defendant. And it's it noted that it was concerned that there was going to be mental health evidence being presented in light of the previous history in this case. The trial court also made clear that it was concerned about the denial of this reciprocal evaluation of the defendant if the defendant was planning on presenting mental health evidence. And it stated that if the defendant wished to present the mental health evidence, it was going to have to proceed and comply with the insanity statutes. And in these pretrial hearings, the defendant refused to disclose that, in fact, he was going to rely on psychiatric evidence or some sort of mental health testimony regarding his history.
We do agree, though, that insanity and involuntary intoxication are separate defenses that are distinct, right?
I think that's fair, but where a defendant intends to rely on mental health evidence, mental health history, mental health diagnoses, he's putting his mental health at issue in the Commonwealth House.
Sure, but if it's mental health under a separate box of involuntary intoxication, then we proceed that way versus mental health evidence for insanity, some disease or defect of the mind. They're just different things. So I don't know why the fact that there's a psychiatrist who's over here or over here, why should the nature of the testimony or the credentialing of the person testifying matter so much as the nature of the defense?
I think that the answer is twofold. First, I think that you could say that the involuntary intoxication defense is in fact an application of the Naughton. It goes to the sanity or the insanity of the defendant. Stamper makes clear that once you have exceeded outside the boundaries of sanity, you fall into the insanity defense.
Yeah, the standard is the same. It's McNaughton, but you get it. It's a different path up that same mountain.
I guess my response is that in this case, the circuit court was very clear that if he wished to present mental health testimony, he was going to have to submit to an evaluation by the Commonwealth. And the defendant acknowledged that was the court's position. But
the statute is directed at insanity, which is different from voluntary intoxication. So maybe the court can do this sort of pretrial order or something like that, but in terms of strictly the statute, it says one thing, which is insanity, so it's plain language, and then we have this somewhat nebulous involuntary intoxication that doesn't seem to be covered by the plain language of the statute.
The trial court had the inherent authority, though, to apply the insanity statute given the information that he had from the defendant. It had the inherent authority to say that it would be fundamentally unfair for you to present mental health evidence that relies on mental history and evaluation of the defendant without permitting the Commonwealth to do some sort of commensurate and reciprocal evaluation. So where the circuit court said, if you want to put on this evidence, you need to comply with the insanity notice statutes, you need to comply with the evaluation by the Commonwealth, that was not an abuse of discretion to limit his presentation of the evidence in that way.
What does it mean when the Court of Appeals says that involuntary intoxication falls within the Stamper rule because it's recognized as an alternative basis for an insanity defense, so long as the defendant satisfies the Naughton rule? I find that internally inconsistent. Do you?
Your Honor, I think that the point that the Court of Appeals was trying to make that is that where the defendant seeks to put on evidence with respect to his mental state to satisfy McNaughton, it falls within the confines of Stamper in that he cannot put on that mental state evidence without pleading insanity. Maybe that wasn't more clear than Court of Appeals.
There are certain obligations by the defense, including an examination.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If he's pleading insanity, and it's clear that that's what he's pleading, he has certain obligations that he's got to deal with.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And he didn't.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And he said it wasn't insanity.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The Court of Appeals said It's recognized, involuntary intoxication is recognized as an alternative basis for an insanity defense, so long as the defendant satisfies the McNaughton rule. And when I read that, I mean, it says it's an alternative basis for insanity so long as the defendant satisfies the insanity rule. That's how I read that.
I do think that Morgan, in particular, in Morgan, the appellate court held that you can demonstrate insanity by involuntary intoxication. So there are situations where insanity, where a defendant can demonstrate that he's operating outside the boundaries of sanity due to his involuntary intoxication.
So is it fair? I don't want to put any words in your mouth. I'm just trying to figure this out. Is it fair to say that your position at this point is you can have an alternative basis for the insanity defense, but because it falls within the Stamper rule, as the Court of Appeals recognized, but it has to be recognized and affirmed as an insanity defense, and that was not what the defendant was willing to do?
I think that the Commonwealth's position is that when the defendant puts his mental state at issue, he must, and the circuit court makes clear to him that any sort of mental health, mental state evidence is only admissible when the Commonwealth is given that reciprocal right to evaluate that it's appropriate to apply these insanity statutes. So in this case, the Court of Appeals properly held that he was bound by the insanity statutes when he was seeking to satisfy the monotony rule through mental state evidence.
Has any other court equated in this way involuntary intoxication and insanity? I mean, there's all these cases that your opposing counsel side that says, well, look, they get at the same problem, which is lack of or presence of criminal intent and responsibility, but they're just different avenues that are distinct in a number of ways. I don't know of any other court that has said, oh, they're basically the same thing. There's just involuntary intoxication. That's just under this broad umbrella of insanity. It's just a different kind of thing.
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case of that nature either, and I would just point out that this is not a case where he was relying solely on toxicology evidence or pharmacology evidence. This is where he was relying on a differential diagnosis by his expert witness who evaluated him, and he admitted in the motion to clarify, which he filed in June of 2016, that his defense required the admission of psychiatric testimony, and including a diagnosis.
That may be where you say, look, at this point, I'm exercising my discretion to require you, out of fairness to the other side, to submit to a comparable evaluation. That's one thing, but it's another thing to say the statute applies, right? I mean, it's one thing to say, look, statute doesn't apply, but here's my discretion, I'm making you do this, right?
I think that given the lengthy history in this case, it was appropriate for the court to say that given that this case has been going on for years, that we extensively litigated, I asked you in December of last year, do you plan to put on mental health testimony that's specifically related to you? I asked you if you planned to put on mental health testimony related to an evaluation of your client. That where the defendant declined to disclose that, the court did not abuse its discretion in finding that defense was barred.
It's hard to understand the catch-22 theory because the trial judge is just trying to figure out what to do. And he says, I start off with Stamper. I can't allow anything in unless it comes through the proper gates. And the gate here is McNaughton. If you don't have that, we're not going to go any further. You give me an insanity notice. Tell me, what is this? You have to, quote, elect it. Elect whether it's an insanity notice or not. He says, it's not. It is not, quote, an insanity notice. And the trial judge quite reasonably says, all right, well then, like I said a second ago, you're not going to put on any psychiatric evidence. In all likelihood, we get to trial. And he said something along the lines of, well, that's the risk I'm taking. So it's not like a catch-22. It's like a gamble, and the gamble failed.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's the Commonwealth's position. And I think that it's clear from the pretrial hearings that the primary concern of the trial court was that the defendant was not going to be permitted to put on mental health evidence. The trial court made clear that would not be permitted absent some sort of insanity defense. And I would note that I believe it was the Commonwealth at some point, you know, actually articulated, it's fine if he later decides he doesn't want to go down that road, but we're still entitled to the evaluation if he does intend to put on that evidence of mental state. And so where the Commonwealth's position is that 19.2-168.1 does not infringe on a circuit court's inherent authority to limit the admission of relevant evidence whose admission would result in undue prejudice to the Commonwealth, where the Commonwealth has not had the opportunity to garner the tools that it could use to rebut that evidence.
Is that right, though? I mean, because he did make clear that he was teeing up a defense of involuntary intoxication, that he's taking all these drugs, and so why can't you have an expert? I mean, even if he's not evaluating the defendant specifically, to just say, look at this conduct, and that's not what the interaction of these drugs would do. I mean, involuntary intoxication would be he's falling over, he's incoherent. It's not planning something of this nature and then executing it and then trying to destroy evidence after. So, I mean, there certainly was plenty of advance notice ahead of trial that this was what the defendant wanted to do. Why is the Commonwealth disarmed to bring in an expert to say, that's all a bunch of hooey, and it's not involuntary intoxication?
Well, the prosecutor certainly had notice that the defendant planned on putting on some sort of toxicology evidence, but repeatedly he refused to disclose that he was going to put on evidence with respect to his mental health history, with respect to any diagnoses that he might have received, and with respect to any forensic evaluation. And so, given that, the Commonwealth was presumably operating under the assumption that that sort of evidence was not going to be admitted. And to go to the point that the court made, wherein there was ample evidence to demonstrate that he was not unconscious or operating under some sort of delirium at the time that he committed these offenses.
But delirium is itself a DSM-5 diagnosis. It's not just a generalized thing.
Well, it's also clear, and to narrow the issue, it's clear that he does not, his behavior demonstrates that he did not satisfy the Manhattan test. He operated, and this goes to the Commonwealth's harmless error argument, he operated, there was planning involved. There was, the evidence shows that he made untruthful statements, inconsistent statements. He made statements to the police at the time of his arrest that he later denied while on the stand during his testimony. That is evidence indicative of his guilt, or that the fact finder was entitled to see as indicative of his guilt. The Commonwealth would argue that he failed to show that there was an absence of volition in the taking of this medication. He admitted to the police officers that he had taken 2 fentanyl patches in the past. He admitted that he had taken this the muscle relaxers. And as to point specifically to the, I would just suggest that his behavior during the time of the attack on the victims demonstrated that he was lucid. I see that my time is up. Thank you for your consideration.
Bottom.
I think it's, just to give Your Honor some additional context of this question, is this an insanity notice? I think it's, taking that one question out of context about the broader discussion that was going on, doesn't fully capture exactly what was being asked. I think this is, if the court wants to look at this later, this is all in my reply brief. I spent a lot of time on that in the reply brief just discussing that point. Footnote 3, this was from the December 23rd hearing, determined what the court was going to do. Says we're talking about standard that is identical to insanity. There's nothing that is short of insanity here. It's the same standard. It's a different cause. We're saying that we rise to the level of the legal standard for insanity, the exact same level as always has been held to be the fundamental standard of legal responsibility in Virginia. It's just the cause that's different. It's the only thing that's different here. In the prior hearing, the court had said, I guess you're saying that you're willing to submit to an evaluation by an expert if ordered as part of an insanity defense. And the response was that the objection is based on a belief that the insanity statutes do not apply to involuntary intoxication. But if the court disagrees...
May I interrupt you for a second because you're running out of time? But at the time the decision was made, the trial judge's statement was this, quote, I think you have to elect whether you have given the court an insanity notice, and I will treat it as such and proceed from there, or you tell me it's not an insanity notice, even though when I read it I thought it was. But if you tell me it's not, I believe I have to accept your representation because you get to choose. Defense counsel's response, it's not an insanity notice.
I believe that the context shows the question we're answering assumed this false dichotomy.
I don't dispute that. That's why I say I don't see why it's a catch-22. You made a strategic call. It didn't work out. But it might have worked out. And it might have been a brilliant call because you kept them from having any sort of evaluation and you might have won the case if you'd gotten a different decision from a trial judge, but it just didn't play out. It might have been a brilliant call.
Just one last point for a finish. With respect to preparation or notice by the Commonwealth, they were given all the records, both from that night and from the client's history. And the court not only circumscribed evidence about the evaluation of the defendant, they wouldn't even let us talk about toxicology, so psychosis, delirium, and dissociation. So I'm out of time now, so thank you very much.
Before you sit down, let me ask you, do you agree that what you were actually saying is it's not an insanity defense, and the reason why is because involuntary intoxication basically takes the place of mental disease or defect, and you're still subject to the McNaughton rule that the defendant was unable to understand the nature, character, and consequences of his act or to distinguish from right from wrong, but that McNaughton rule is confined to mental disease or defect. I'm outside of that because I'm not relying on mental disease or defect. I'm relying on involuntary intoxication. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying?
Assuming that the mental disease and defect is a element of the Manhattan test, it's essentially Manhattan with a different clause. That's my position.
Say that again.
It's the same legal standard the same mental state that meets that legal standard, but with a different cause. So with the cause being substances rather than a serious mental illness.
In essence, you're saying there was a mental defect caused by involuntary intoxication.
Sorry?
In essence, are you saying there was a mental defect caused by involuntary intoxication?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
So I think...
I'm not sure that I understand the distinction between what you are saying and what was just restated by Justice Goodman.
I might be confused at this point.
I am.
Let me try it, because my question obviously prompted this, so if I'm at fault, let me see if I can clear up one. The McNaughton rule has as its linchpin that the defendant is unable to understand the nature, character, and consequences of his act or to distinguish right from wrong. We agree with that?
Yes.
All right. Then the question is why? And the why is, in the McNaughton rule, the traditional rule, is that it is a pre-existing mental disease or defect. Now, you say that the McNaughton rule is the only true insanity rule in Virginia. Correct?
Yes.
Because mental disease and defect is not the source of the consequences. It's involuntary intoxication.
Correct.
Right, now, that's what I understood his position to be.
Okay.
Am I right?
Yes. I think that... Just the vagueness in the term mental disease and defect, maybe getting a little too in the weeds with that, but what you just said is an accurate statement.
So, but one step further, is you're saying it's not an insanity defense because of that?
Because the cause is different, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Call the next case.